from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Colleges and universities send out acceptance letters this week to nervous high school seniors who started checking their mailboxes weeks ago. Now, parents have to figure out how they will pay for their children's college education. Adding up tuition, books, room, and board, the average four-year private college cost $29,500 this year. At many schools, this number is closer to $40,000. Public university tuitions, too, are running far ahead of inflation, up 48% in Michigan, 52% in Maryland, 80% in Idaho in the last decade. And many schools are shifting their aid money from students who need it most to the most desirable students. New analysis says hundreds of thousands of low-income high school seniors this year will not get a bachelor's degree because of cost. Meanwhile, many colleges are building hotel-like dormitories, top-notch gyms, and enormous stadiums to stay competitive. Tonight on Point, the increasingly unbearable cost of higher education. Are you in the throes of sticker shock? Can you afford the college your son or daughter really wants? Are you sure? Are Americans getting their money's worth from their high-priced college educations? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Anthony Brooks, higher education correspondent for National Public Radio. Anthony, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Tom. Nice to talk to you.
Anthony, everybody's talking and writing about how high college tuitions and expenses are going. How high is high these days?
Well, you articulated a bunch of the numbers. I've got a few more. Last year, average tuition and fees for in-state students at a four-year public college, up 14%. Just in the past year. Yeah, in 1 year. Private colleges up 6%. That doesn't sound as high, but bear in mind that private colleges charge a whole lot more to begin with, so the actual increase is a lot higher.
And it's much more than inflation, which was practically nil.
Much more than inflation. Tuition and fees have been growing, though. I think you also mentioned this in your intro. For the last couple of decades, past 10 years, fees are up 47% at the publics, 42% at the privates. And there's no end in sight. It's sort of like that adage, you know, taxes and you can count on taxes and death. It seems like you can count on tuition and fees to continue to rise in the years ahead.
But parents feel that at some point, and some point feel it very deeply. What is driving tuitions up so high?
Well, there's a lot of reasons, and I was looking for the simple answer. I just worked on a piece on this very question just in the last couple of weeks for NPR, and it's a number of things, and you sort of need to separate the publics from the privates. I mean, there's some things that they share in common. I mean, the increased costs of technology affects both publics and privates. I mean, for instance, I was looking at a project up at the University of Vermont, which, as you know, is an old stately university up there in northern Vermont by the New York border, and they're building new dormitories, and they need them. I mean, in their defense, I mean, the ones they have are pretty shabby. But now to build new dormitories, they all have to be wired for the Internet. That wasn't a cost that colleges and universities had to consider when you went to college. You didn't have to think of that wiring. And it's the whole lot of technology that goes along with these buildings that wasn't there before. Health insurance, as we know, is a huge issue for the entire nation. It's a big issue for colleges and universities. Faculty and staff have to be insured. That is rising, and so that's a big issue. Insurance, utilities, and then, of course, the increased cost of financial aid. There has to be more financial aid. Someone has to pay for it. The colleges are the source of a lot of that aid. So that's a cost that goes up. And also, and you put your finger, I think, on another issue, although there's some, depending on who you talk to, mm-hmm. there's argument about how big a factor this is, but the sort of arms race, if you will, that colleges and universities are engaged in. I mean, there's a great example right across the street from you, Tom, at BU, being built as we speak, a Boston University, mm-hmm. a $200 million student village. And as each college and university invests in these new facilities, they have to keep up with the one down the street or across the state or across the country that's doing the same thing. These are all costs that get passed on to students.
And passed on at a tremendous clip. Companies can't pass on costs at the increases generally at the rate of 6% or 14% a year. On the other hand, I guess there's nothing here that's outsourced. They're not outsourcing to China or India the education. It happens in the United States. What's the effect of all this, Anthony, on students and on their families?
Well, the effects are, I mean, I think there's growing concern that, to put it bluntly, that some people are going to be just priced out of college. And again, I don't want to be too alarmist, because you'll talk to people within academia who will make a case that these rise in prices mm-hmm. aren't as steep as they sound, because there's so much aid available that the actual net price is much lower than the sticker price suggests. However, there are researchers at the Department of Education that I spoke to that says there are now some 170,000 students across this country that are college ready that just can't afford to enroll. And that if prices continue to rise as they are, and if grant levels stay more or less flat as they have, that by the end of the decade, some 2 million Americans won't be able to enroll in college. And in a way, you're already seeing that, because community colleges have been a great place for people to go for lots of different reasons, among the reasons, including that they're less expensive. But because of a drop-off in state funding, some community colleges just simply don't have enough programs for the number of people that actually want to enroll in them.
Now, a lot of states have been cutting back on their support of state universities.
Yeah, and that's sort of, to go back to the first answer to my question, mm-hmm. you know, when you talk about rising tuition and why the publics have gone up at a faster clip than the privates, you've got to talk about a drop-off in state support. And in fact, there's, you know, the standard line in public institution is that they've shifted from being public institutions to being publicly assisted institutions to being publicly located institutions. And I think, if I'm correct, the average public subsidy for a state college or university is about 30%. That's the average. So, again, University of Vermont, which is one of the most expensive public colleges, for good reason, they get 9% of their budget from the state. So you ask yourself, you know, you can be forgiven for asking, where's the public in public education if there's this kind of drop off from state support from these public universities?
When it's down to 9%. Now, last fall, there was talk in Congress of legislation that would hold a kind of sword above colleges and universities. And say, I forget what the details were, but if their tuition went up too quickly, they'd be, they'd be cut off from government support. What happened with that drive?
Well, this was an idea put forth chiefly by Buck McKeon, who's a California Republican on the Education and Workforce Committee, and he came up with the idea. And he's of the mind that the reason college costs are out of control is because of this lavish spending. And he said that his proposal was that if colleges or universities, and they were talking about the publics, raise their prices beyond the consumer price index, they would lose federal funds. Actually, no, let me correct myself. All universities mm-hmm. and colleges, if they raise their tuition faster than the consumer price index, they would lose whatever federal subsidies they get. Now, the Democrats jumped all over him and a lot of college administrators and said that smacks of price controls. That's hardly a Republican idea. And he had to back down. But a lot of people have given him credit for at least raising the debate. It certainly got people sort of asking the question, not only why is this happening, but what should be done to control it. So he's backed off of that a little bit. It should also be pointed out that he says he backed off because of some colleges and universities began doing some stuff on their own, most notably Harvard University, which announced just a few weeks ago that low-income students wouldn't have to pay anything to attend, ones that had been accepted. And some other big state colleges have done that as well. The University of Virginia recently offered to convert loans to low-income students to outright grants. And other universities have taken on ideas such as promising to keep tuition level for the full 4 years that students attend, so there wouldn't be the sort of new sticker shock surprise,
mm-hmm.
you know,
year.
The sophomore or junior year or whatever it is. So that's certainly, when you talk of solutions, that's going to be part of the discussion, is that colleges and universities sort of have to step up to the table and take some action themselves.
But it sounds at this point still like kind of nibbling at the edges of a problem that many families are going to be facing very directly, very soon. Anthony Brooks, it's just great having you tonight. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Anthony Brooks, National Public Radio. I want to turn now to Loudonville, New York, where we're joined by Ronald Ehrenberg. He's director of the Higher Education Research Institute at Cornell. Good evening and welcome, Ronald Ehrenberg.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us tonight, Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst and Senior Editor of the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
We are looking at these very high jumps in college education costs. Ronald Ehrenberg, we just heard Anthony Brooks tracking down some of the causes of this. You've done a lot of research on this. You've got a book, Tuition Rising, Why College Costs So Much. But I wonder just about the impact you've seen on families. Are families able to step up and deal with this? What's the cost to the internal economics of a family when they're shouldering the kind of increases we've seen in the university arena?
Well, let me first say that I think Anthony Brooks was right on target, and everything he said was absolutely correct. And most of what goes on is not actually being shouldered by families, but it's being shouldered by students in the form of increasing loans, which is to say that while it used to be the case that the expectation is that college would be paid for by families themselves and maybe with some support, government support or institutional aid, increasingly loan burdens are becoming part of the game.
Can you put some numbers on that?
Well, I can give you an example, which is to say that at least from the federal government, while in around 1980, about 50% of federal aid was in the form of grant aid, now currently it's under 40%. So most federal financial aid now comes in the form of loans. And the sort of the notion is that there is a considerable payoff to higher education, and so students are investing in this activity, and they're going to return over a large number of years. But what we have to be concerned about, although there really is no substantive evidence on this, is that these loan burdens are going to affect the occupational choices of students. You don't take out $50,000 or $60,000 in college debt and then go on to become a public school teacher, and because that's not an occupation that's going to allow you to repay the debt.
In other words, everybody's going to have to suddenly become an investment banker to get out from under their college debt.
I think that's something that we should be very, very concerned about, and that we should think, especially in public institutions, of establishing programs which permit people to enter these occupations that are socially important, but that do not provide the financing to repay large debt burdens.
Jack Beatty, many, many angles on this issue. Ronald Ehrenberg has just raised another, that it may actually have large, broad effects on the kinds of career choices that people make. But the roots of this, the impact of it, go forward with students' loan package and also forward with parents' indebtedness and reduced retirement savings as they shell out for the kids.
Yes, and we really have gone backwards. I mean, this year the Higher Education Act of 1965 will be renewed, and President Lyndon Johnson set out an ambitious goal in that. He said, quote, that a high school student anywhere in this great land can apply to any college or any university is in any of the 50 states and not be turned away because his family is poor. And yet here's the Century Foundation telling us that 74% of the students at the nation's top 150 colleges come from the richest socioeconomic quartile and just 3% from the poorest. Put it another way, one is you're 25 times more likely to run into a rich student as a poor one at the nation's top 146 colleges.
That is impressive. Ronald Ehrenberg, does that stack up with what you're seeing, the kind of tilt toward affluence?
That's partially right. We don't want to blame differences in college attendance rates by income solely on the tuition and financial aid policies of these selective private universities, because a lot of it has to do with the types of education that students get at the elementary and secondary level.
But of course, that often comes back to income and neighborhood,
right,
as well.
Right, exactly. But what I do think is that we have to remember these private institutions get extraordinary benefits under the tax codes. Their endowment income, the income that their assets earn, is not taxable under federal and state law.
And so they get some breaks. Ron Ehrenberg, Jack Beatty, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the unbearable cost in many cases of college in America. Who's paying what and how for college? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about who's paying what and how for college acceptance and rejection letters going out this week. Are you in the throes of sticker shock? Can you afford the college your kid really wants? Are you sure? Are Americans getting their money's worth from a college education, or is the college chase now a kind of status racket, a kind of marketing scam that we're all a part of? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from Loudoun, New York, by Ronald Ehrenberg. He's author of Tuition Rising, Why College Costs So Much. He's director of Cornell's Higher Education Research Institute. And right now from Bradford, England, across the pond, we're joined by Sandy Baum. She's professor of economics at Skidmore College. She's spoken before Congress on the cost of higher education. She's a consultant to the College Board. Good evening, and thanks for staying up for us, Sandy Baum.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, thanks for being with us. Sandy, you said, let's be careful when we look at these numbers, that as heavy as it may seem, the price of college is not as bad as it may appear. What do you mean by that?
Right. Well, there are two things that have come out so far that I think need to be qualified a bit. One has to do with student debt. And the typical student graduates from a four-year college now with about $20,000 of debt. And that's not unmanageable for most students. Many of them actually graduate, go out and buy a new car and borrow that much all over again. Thinking about the investment and paying off the loans, for some students, that amount of debt is a problem, and we need to be concerned about that. But most of the evidence indicates that to date, very few students have actually changed their career plans as a result of student debt. So there are certain professions that are a problem, but not most.
All right.
And the second thing has to do with what students actually pay and the net price. You used Harvard as an example before. If a low-income student can go to Harvard and their parents don't have to pay anything, it's not the price that's the problem. It's the net price that students pay, net of grant aid, that should really be taken into consideration.
So, it may be true if you're in the lowest economic tier getting to Harvard, and Harvard is now saying, well, we'll cover you if you're at the low end. But I think there are a lot of families out there that are feeling that, like, they're not getting any breaks. That it feels awfully heavy. Is that? Are you saying that's an illusion? That it's just no heavier than it's ever been?
College is very expensive, and it certainly takes a big portion of – it's a big part of people's expenditures. But the fact is that many, many students are getting a lot of grant aid. Not every student is getting grant aid, but low-income students, middle-income students, and increasingly, in my view, unfortunately, a lot of grant aid is also going to more affluent students. So students have to look very carefully at how much they will actually pay.
Ronald Ehrenberg, you've written about exactly that dynamic of more grant aid going to students who may not actually need it financially. Why is that happening?
Well, it's happening because one of the characteristics that makes a college great is the quality of the students that are there. And the result is that colleges are vigorously competing using financial aid to try to attract high test score students. And in the language of admissions people, they're using financial aid to not provide access, but rather for enrollment management purposes, to help enroll the type of class that they want.
To attract those students with very, very high scores.
And... Right. And that would not be a problem if they were doing it with their own money. But, in fact, they're not doing it with their own money. Because, as I was indicating before the break, these private colleges and universities get tremendous tax breaks. They pay no income tax on their endowments. The annual giving that they receive, the corporations and individuals get tax breaks for that. They get to borrow at tax-exempt rates, and they are often exempt from property tax for their property that is used for educational reasons. And we give these breaks to private higher education institutions because we believe they are acting in terms of the social good. But I think we have to define social good more broadly as seeing that all students who are capable of going to these institutions have chances of getting there. And if they are restricting their enrollment patterns mm-hmm. to certain income classes of students, then I think they really risk bringing the wrath of government down upon them.
Sandy Baum, do you see a change in the profile of American students at all universities and colleges, or at particular universities and colleges? Are lower-income students being edged out? Are certain stripes of college being dominated now by affluent or wealthy students?
Well, let me just say, in response to what Ron just said, that in fact, still, I think it's important to note that most of the aid, the institutional aid that's being given out, still is based on need. And it might not be given necessarily only to poor students, but students who don't have the ability to pay are still getting most of the aid that colleges have to give out. Moreover, almost every student who goes to college, whether it's public or private, is being subsidized and paying less than the full cost of their education. So I think it's possible to exaggerate what institutions are doing. I mean, the fact is that the most affluent students who have the highest colleges that have the most affluent colleges with the highest endowments are the ones who are concentrating their aid most carefully on the students who have financial need. So that while there's a serious access gap, and low-income students are certainly much less likely to go to college and to go to selective colleges than are higher-income students, still, to blame it on the institutions and their aid policies, I think is to a great extent, still misleading.
Yeah, Jack Beatty, overall, as you pointed out, at one time the university system was seen as a great leveler, and mainly by lifting lots of Americans up with great education at a price that they could afford. If that's not going on in the same degree, that changes the profile, the mountain range of the society.
It certainly does. And, you know, you can look at two graphs. One would be rising tuition over the last generation, and it's in excess of what it is in excess of tuition. And the other would be narrowing mobility for Americans. That's been one of the marked trends of the last decades. America is a less mobile society economically than it was 30 years ago. And are the two curves related? I don't know. But they're part of a package of growing inequality. And I guess the question, and now as a parent who's just about exhausted every dime he has to get his son through college, yeah. I'm wondering, well, what can government do? And it's interesting, in the current campaign, if you go to the Bush website and hit tuition aid for higher education, all you get back are some speeches the president made where he talked about getting elementary school students ready for college education. Mm-hmm. His emphasis is on no child left behind. Mm-hmm. And otherwise, he thinks his tax cuts provide people enough money to do that. John Kerry has a very ambitious program. Basically, he would give any American a four-year free ticket to the public college in that university in that state in exchange for 2 years of community service after the student leaves high school.
Somebody's going to have to pay for that. How does that add up, Jack?
That comes out of the people who earn more than $200,000 a year forego mm-hmm. the Bush tax cuts. And people who decide not to go to college can use this award for job training or to help start a business or to make a down payment on the purchase of a home. And a kid who goes through college and then says, "What I'd like to do this," can then use that money to defray his loan repayments. And some of the things they could do are, you know, visiting the elderly, reading to them, tutoring kids in school, working in Homeland Defense, on and on and on. And this would be a way, really, of both reinvigorating community service and of putting college within the reach of many middle-class families.
It might be great. On the other hand, if those expenses, if the cost keeps going up, someone's going to have to cover all that one way or another. But it might be great. We've got a lot of callers who want to join us. Let's turn to them. Carl is calling from Londonderry, New Hampshire. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
Basically, we're looking at our daughter going to school in the fall, and we've gone through, we fill out the FAFSA forms and whatnot.
Yeah.
I'd like to know how they figure that you can pay a third of your income before you need any help.
Is that what you're seeing in the forms, one-third right off the top?
Basically, yes. They ask you for your adjusted gross income.
Right.
Before you take out your mortgage payments or any of that kind of stuff, and then they come up with your need amount, and that's approximately a third of what your income is.
Wow. So give us a sense of what kind of bill you're looking at for your daughter's college this fall, Carl.
Well, the school she picked will be approximately $33,000 a year, of which you get the $26,25 the first year of unsubsidized Stafford loans.
Right.
Which the child has to pay back after, what, 6 months after they graduate.
Yep, so and up to.
Right, and the unsubsidized ones collect interest along the way. The subsidized ones don't, so of course you get the unsubsidized ones, so you have to do the interest payments. And the rest, they give you a federal plus loan, which is parental loans for undergraduate students.
That is a parental, so you get to borrow that money.
Correct.
When you look at, if this is the way it goes, and we'll look at your question, but do you expect your daughter to come out with something like that $20,000 in debt that we heard was the average earlier?
At the very least, it'll be around 70.
That's a different kettle of fish.
Absolutely.
That's
Absolutely.
A lot of debt to begin with. Carl, hang on. Ronald Ehrenberg, speak to this. What is the formula for financial aid these days?
Sandy Baum is actually the expert on financial aid, so as long as you have her.
Oh, good. Let's turn there. Sandy, how about it? What are parents expected to produce out of their own income and savings?
Well, certainly the percentage of income that a parent is expected to produce depends on the parent's income. So for lower-income families, the percentage that they're expected to produce is lower. Then it depends on your financial circumstances. You might, if you're a low-income family, be eligible for a Pell Grant of about $4,000. But you're not going to get that if your family income is above about $40,000. There are also subsidized student loans where the interest is actually paid by the government while the student is in school. But it depends, again, on what the family's income is. But the formula is such that it absolutely asks for more than most families could pay for out of their current income, and it expects that families will both have saved ahead of time and borrow while the student is in college.
So when Carl looks at it, it looks to him like they're asking for about a third of their current income. Is that typical?
That's pretty high, but also $70,000 of debt is very high, and I think people should think very hard before they borrow that much money and look again at whether there are some other options that might be available.
But what do you mean by other options? Less expensive universities?
Are they getting all the grant aid that they can? Are the parents really, $70,000 is just a huge percentage of the amount that the total cost of attendance. And if it's a private college, then if that's really the circumstance, then certainly talking to the financial aid office would be very appropriate.
Carl, there's a little advice. We hope it helps. Thanks so much for calling. Let me turn right now to St. Louis, Missouri, where we're joined by Bill Whitbrot. He's Director of Student Financial Services at Washington University in St. Louis. He oversees $60 million in financial awards that go to 3,600 undergraduate students every year. Good evening and welcome, Bill Whitbrot.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. Help us go through these numbers once more here. You're a private university, fairly expensive. Give us a sense of what families coming to Washington University can expect to pay out of pocket. Is there a median there about what people pay, what they have saved, what they borrow, and where financial aid kicks in? Paint the picture for us.
Well, I think when families come to Washington University and their students have been admitted, they tap into a wide variety of resources. Their students apply for merit-based scholarships. Their students apply for need-based financial aid, access their federal entitlements. And then there are programs that are available for parents to pay the parent portion.
And what percentage of your students get financial aid at Washington U?
About 60% of our students get some form of financial aid.
And at what income level does that begin to kick in? Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, there are a range of incomes, but anywhere from zero on up to, a very low six-figure income. It all depends on other factors besides income, like the number of household members in the family, the number of students who are in college at the same time, the age of the parents. That need formula protects parents' assets for retirement depending upon the age of the older parent. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of factors that enter into determining how much financial aid a student's going to receive.
And do you have a sense of what kind of debt burdens Washington University students are going away with?
Yeah, I do. The class that will be graduating this May probably going to have an average debt load of under $25,000.
And this is at a school where tuition and fees and health and room and board come to almost $39,000.
Right.
Or $40,000 this coming year.
Right.
So that's pretty low. So
it's low, and another factor is that we have a very low default rate. So that tells us that, I mean, exceptionally low, mm-hmm. and that tells us that students are able to once they get into the workplace, to pay their loans.
Bill, at what rate are families paying the full load at Washington University, subsidizing families who are getting financial aid? How much of that money is going direct from those paying the full sticker price to help families with lower incomes send their kids to Washington?
Well, a lot of the money that's helping sending low-income students to Washington University is coming from our endowment. But, you know, 40% of our families are paying the full price mm-hmm. to send their students to the university.
But that must be important to you, those full price payers in terms of the financial aid that you are able to extend to folks who can't afford that.
Well, it is important. We try to enroll and attract the most diverse student body that we can, and one of the elements of that diversity is students' economic background. So we do want students who can pay the full price, as well as students who need our help.
I'm looking here at the number for 2004 and 5, Washington University, tuition, fees, health, room and board, $40,838. When parents read that figure, do they go screaming from the room? Do they just bite the bullet? What's the response?
Well, we do a lot of communicating with families who are prospective freshmen, and we send the message out that they can afford a Washington University education and that the university will help them make that education a financial reality. And we encourage them to call our office and let us help them work out a plan individually for them so that their student can attend.
Well, it's a big number, but it sounds as though you're filling up the ranks without too much trouble. Bill Whitbard, thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
You're welcome. My pleasure. Good evening.
Bill Whitbrod, Director of Student Financial Services at Washington University in St. Louis. Well, Jack, there's an expensive school in the middle of the country, 40,000 plus, and they're filling their places.
Yes, and it sounds like they're even making their endowment is making it possible for people who can't pay anything like that freight to get in. I guess the question is how long? If these costs keep going up at this rate, how long will and how much will endowments defray? I think there's got to be a point where they can just defray less and less because of the rising costs. And it seems to me that those costs are just baked into the cake. I mean, the fixed costs and then the variable mm-hmm. ones like, oil and air conditioning and health care.
Lay
all
it right
the
on top.
Things.
Yep.
Boy, all that is like just an elevator, it seems to me, accelerator driving these costs up. And at a certain point, this is going to begin to, if it hasn't already, seriously, it seems to me, affect the future of some youngsters.
Well, the elevator has been headed up, and it's still going there. Sandy Baum, Ronald Ehrenberg, Jack, please stand by. We're talking tonight about who's paying what and how for college. Listeners, you can join the conversation. Have you visited the school of your child's choice? Can you see why it's so expensive? Is college becoming a rich kid's game again? And are you qualifying for financial aid? How much does it ease the burden? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking tonight at who's paying what and how for college. Tuitions are high and rising. Acceptance letters are coming out this week. One may be arriving at your doorstep. Do you know what it's going to take out of your family's hide to pay that bill? Are Americans getting their money's worth from a college education? Students, how much debt are you ready to take on for college? And parents, is your sacrifice worth the gain? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Joined tonight from Bradford, England, by Sandy Baum, professor of economics at Skidmore College. From Loudonville, New York, by Ronald Ehrenberg, author of Tuition Rising. Michelle is calling from Tewksbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Michelle. You're on the air.
Hi, this is a fascinating show. I have a master's degree. I graduated in 1997. When I finished my undergrad, and I attended a very expensive private school, and I was lucky in sort of the financial aid that I got, so I did only end my undergraduate with about $20,000 of debt. However, the net income of the family that was there was $200,000 a year.
This was your family supporting you in college, you're saying?
No, my family income, which was myself only, was $10,000. But most of the kids I went to school with, this is.
Oh, I see. You were surrounded by kids who your impression was their typical family income was $200,000.
Oh, the school, yeah, published that amount.
Wow.
Yes, so I knew that. I was going to school with a bunch of rich kids, and I myself was, you know, wondering how I could buy, you know, groceries.
Right.
However, when I went to get my master's degree, and this is the problem, you know, most places, if you want to get hired, you have to have a master's degree, and grants stop once you want to go to get your master's. There's no federal grant aid, so most people borrow money completely to get a master's degree, unless your parents are wealthy. So when I finished my education, I was $60,000 in debt.
How is it going carrying that debt? Has it paid off so far?
Well, I have. When I first got out of school, I am a teacher, not a public school teacher, mm-hmm. but a piano teacher.
Yep.
So, of course, when I first got out of school, I couldn't make the payments at all. The payments were $600 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have the debt accrued, and I owed $80,000 a year from just interest. So I am now down to owing $78,000.
So it's going up, not down. That's kind of the wrong way. What do you take away from all this, Michelle? If you had it to do over again, would you do something different?
Well, no, I wouldn't do anything different because the one thing they can't take away is your education. Once you have it, you have it. But what I don't think is right is that people have to mortgage their lives in order to get an education. I myself will not live the American dream of being able to buy a house.
Because you've already got the equivalent of a mortgage on your back from the cost of college itself. Michelle, thanks very much for your call. I want to put it to our guest, Ronald Ehrenberg. What do you make of this story?
I think we have to remember that you don't have to go to an expensive private university.
And many people do not.
Two-thirds of American four-year college students go to public higher education.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as there are high-quality public alternatives, we don't have to worry about the type of situation that was just described arising frequently. The problem is that state support for public higher education institutions has gone down to the extent that what goes on in the public sector now is often not comparable to what goes on in the private sector.
Do you mean the quality of education?
Yeah, and I just want to give you some examples. So if you went back to 1980, and you looked at faculty salaries, you would find that at the large universities, faculty in public universities were making about 92% of what faculty in private universities are making.
And over time, that may create a difference in the quality of education.
Well, that was back then. If you look today, it's now 77%. So you have to ask yourself, are the publics being able to attract and retain high-quality faculty? The other thing that has happened is that increasingly, especially at the large public institutions, you're not taught by regular faculty because the universities don't have the funding to employ regular faculty. Very often you're taught by part-time adjuncts or non-tenure-track lecturers. And so there is a great concern that the public sector is abdicating its responsibility to provide quality higher education, which is supposed to serve as a vehicle for mobility.
Lower cost, but maybe a price that comes with that. Let me get one more call. Frank is calling from Boston. Hi, Frank. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I very much agree with what was public school and what public colleges. That is that what's happening is that they're not being properly funded and cutting back on services. Also point out, so what one of the real concerns is here is that what we call people who are, quote, able to afford an education is much lower than a college such as WashU states that they are. If you take a family with $160,000 of income, that's pre-tax dollars.
Sure.
And yet they're supposed to, with two kids, be able to afford $80,000 if they were to send the kids to a school that they feel is appropriate for what they're doing. Now, it is true they could go to public schools, but if the public schools in the state aren't able to have the quality that they want, then they have a problem. UVM, for example, which was a fine institution, just cut many of its sports, including men's and women's tennis. They have inadequate facilities and housing, and it still has many good things to offer, but it is not properly funded.
It can dig awfully deep into a family's income. Frank, thanks very much for your call. Sandy Baum, a last thought from you there in England. Are we developing a real problem here, or is your message, oh, we're fine, just as steady as she goes?
No, we're certainly not fine. I mean, we have a real problem with access to college for low-income students. I would say I'm in England right now talking to people about the problems here. They have very low tuition, but they have the similar problem with lack of access for low-income students. So even if we froze tuition right now, that problem would persist. And I do think it's important to reiterate, because I don't want this conversation to make people think that they can't go to college. 70% of students are going to colleges that charge less than $8,000 in tuition, and many of those students are getting help paying that tuition. So people should not lose hope. They should get lots of information and try to find out where they can go that will actually be affordable and they can get a quality education.
Lots of opportunities, and talk to your congressman and make sure that those universities stay open and flourishing. Sandy Baum, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Sandy Baum, Professor of Economics at Skidmore College, and Ronald Ehrenberg, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Ronald Ehrenberg, Director of Cornell's Higher Education Research Institute and author of Tuition Rising. Jack Beatty, I guess it's just more turning of the pockets inside out. We don't have a full solution here tonight. It still costs a lot.
It sure does. And I think of Michelle with her $78,000 mortgage. My gosh, how do you work that off? And she's right. I mean, that means foregone consumption probably for the rest of her life. This is a very significant diminishment of her life chances.
Let's hope she puts a very high value on that education. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
In a moment, an inspiring message to those high school seniors who don't get into the college of their choice. This is On Point. It is the dreaded sight for college-bound high school seniors, the thin envelope from the college of their choice. In many teens' minds, rejection from a college represents failure on their part. Maybe if they had just studied a little harder or put a little more effort into that essay, former Boston Globe columnist David Nyan sees things differently. Here he reads from his column, To Those Who Got a No, from an admissions dean.
The rejections arrive in early April in thin, cheap envelopes, some with a crummy window for name and address, as if it were a bill, and none with the thick packet you'd hoped for. Dear so-and-so, the admissions committee gave full consideration, but I regret to inform you we will be unable to offer you a place in the class of 2006. Lots of applicants, limited number of spaces, blah, blah, blah. Good luck with your undergraduate career. Very truly yours, Assistant Dean Blowhard, rejection writer, Old Overshoe University. This is the season of college acceptance letters, so it's also the time of rejection. You're in or you're out. Today's the day you learn how life is not like high school. To the ins who got where they wanted to go, congrats, great, good luck, have a nice life, see you later. The rest of this is for the outs. You sort of felt it was coming. Your SAT scores weren't the greatest. Your transcript had some holes in it. You wondered what your teacher's recommendations would really say or imply. And you can't help thinking about that essay you finished at 2 a.m. of the day you absolutely had to mail in your application. That essay which was, well, a little weird. Maybe you could have pulled that C in sociology up to a B-. Maybe you shouldn't have quit soccer to get a job to pay for your gas. Maybe it was that down period during sophomore year when you had mono and didn't talk to your teachers for 3 months while you vegged out. What difference does it make what it was? It still hurts. It hurts where you feel pain most, inside. It's not like the usual heartache that kids have, the kind other people can't see. An alcoholic parent, a secret shame, a gaping wound in the family fabric. These are things one can carry to school and mask with a grin, a wisecrack, a scowl, a just don't mess with me today attitude. But everybody knows where you got in and where you didn't. Sure, the letter comes to the house, but eventually you've still got to face your friends. Any mail for me is like asking for a knuckle sandwich. Thanks a lot for the kick in the teeth. What a bummer. How do you tell kids at school? That's the hard part. The squeals in the corridor from the kids who got in someplace desirable, the supercilious puss in the ones who got early acceptance, or the girl whose old man has an in at Old Ivy. There's the class doofus who suddenly becomes the first nerd accepted at Princeton. The 125-pound wrestling jock who, surprise, surprise, got into MIT. But what about you? You've heard about special treatment for this category or that category, alumni kids and a legacy ticket, or affirmative action luckouts, or rebounders, or oboe players. Maybe they were trying to fill certain slots. But you're not a slot. You're you. They can look at your grades and weigh your scores and see how many years you were in French club. But they can't look into your head or into your heart. They can't check out the guts department. This is the important thing. They didn't reject you. They rejected your resume. They gave some other kid the benefit of the doubt. Maybe that kid deserved a break. Don't you deserve a break? Sure, you'll get one. Maybe this is the reality check you needed. Maybe the school that does eventually take you will be good. Maybe this is the day you start to grow up. Look at some people who've accomplished a lot and see where they started. Ronald Reagan, Eureka College. Jesse Jackson, they wouldn't let him play quarterback in the Big Ten, so he quit Illinois for North Carolina A&T. Do you know that the chairman of both General Motors and General Electric graduated from UMass? Bob Dole, he went to Washburn Municipal University. The minority leader of the U.S. Senate, now majority leader, Tom Daschle, went to South Dakota State. Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Dennis Hastert, went to Northern Illinois University. Dick Armey, the House Majority Leader, took a bachelor's degree from Jamestown College. Winston Churchill, so slow a learner, they used to write his mother to please come take this boy off our hands. I know what you think. Spare me the sympathy. It still hurts. But let's keep this in perspective. What did Magic Johnson say to the little boy who also tested HIV positive? He said, "You've got to have a positive attitude." What happens when you don't keep a positive attitude? Don't ask. This college thing, what happened is that you rubbed up against the reality of big time, maybe big name institutions. Some they pick, some they don't. You lost. It'll happen again. But let's hope it won't have the same awful kick. You'll get tossed by a girlfriend or a boyfriend. You won't get the job or the promotion you thought you deserved. Some disease may pluck you from life's fast lane and pin you to a bed, a wheelchair, a coffin. That happens. Bad habits you can change. Bad luck is nothing you can do anything about. Does it mean you're not a good person? People like you, if not your resume. There's no one else that can be you. Plenty of people think you're special now, or will think that, once they get to know you, because you are. And the admissions department that said no? Screw them. You've got a life to lead.
David Nyhan is a former columnist for the Boston Globe and now a syndicated columnist. This column first appeared in 1987. Dave recorded it for us in 2002. We figured it still applied. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.